Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. If I asked you to associate a religious tradition with a region known as Latin America, chances are you would say Roman Catholicism. And, for the most part, you would be correct. Since colonization in the early 16th century, Latin America, that widely diverse area stretching from Mexico in the north to Chile in the south, has been predominantly Catholic, at least in name. Shortages of priests during the colonial period, aggravated by political conflict in the 1800s, meant that many Catholics, especially in rural areas, would rarely see a member of the clergy. Various forms of unofficial folk Catholicism would flourish in areas not served regularly by priests. Beginning in the early to middle part of the 20th century, however, the religious landscape began to change as evangelical Protestantism and Pentecostalism began growing rapidly in a number of countries, including Brazil, Chile, and Guatemala. By the end of the 1900s, some researchers have claimed that there are as many practicing Protestants as there are practicing Catholics in these countries. And other nations that were initially slow to see Protestant growth are now witnessing a significant expansion of evangelicals. Where did these Protestants come from? How have they expanded? And what do they look like compared to their brethren in the United States? These are the questions that we will explore today with Professor Ruth Melkonian of Gordon College in Wenham, Massachusetts. Dr. Melkonian is an assistant professor and department chair of political science at that institution, having earned her PhD at Emory University in Atlanta. Professor Melkonian recently caught my attention with an article she penned with Dennis Hoover regarding the political attitudes of Protestants to the south of us entitled Latin American Evangelicals, Made in Whose Image? We will link to that essay on our website so you can take a look at it. Also, as a reminder, to check out our Facebook page and friend us or like us, because then you'll be able to get regular updates on what's coming up on the show, as well as some of my comments on what I thought about some of the podcast. You can also join the discussion there, as well as we'll be opening up a discussion page. We are quickly approaching our 50th episode here on Research on Religion, so there's a lot of stuff to talk about. But today, it's about Latin American evangelicals. Ruth, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you.
Hey, first off, I got to ask you, you're an assistant professor, but you got stuck with the position of being department chair. How did that end up?
Well, I don't know if you've been following Gordon College at all, but apparently Gordon has an affinity for young leadership. So recently, Michael Lindsay, who's a sociology professor focused on religion at Rice, who is younger than me, was just named our next college president.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Thankfully, I will be an associate professor next year, and I'm up for tenure right now. So I'm close. But in part, it's because we are a department of four, and three of the four of us arrived in the last 6 years. So I'm second in logging the most time here, even if I'm not the most senior. So
okay, so it's kind of on a rotating basis. And
well, and the previous chair is right currently on sabbatical, and he took that as a good time to exit. So here I am.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you're in the process of getting tenure, or have you heard back yet?
I'm in the process.
Okay. Well, it should probably not be any problem. Is it kind of weird being department chair and having a tenure case at the same time? Because I know department chairs are supposed to actually do that.
I'm not going
to
recommend myself.
Okay. Well, you should recommend yourself, because if you don't, who will? Yeah. Okay. Well, all right. Interesting place, young people. So for the folks in the audience who are might be high schoolers or homeschoolers, Gordon College, if you want a young and vibrant place, that is the place to be, I guess. All right, let's talk about Latin American Protestantism now. And as I noted in our introduction,
here just a minute ago, most people would be surprised to hear that Protestantism has made substantial inroads in Latin America, a region that we typically think of as being culturally Catholic. In fact, when I did my dissertation research on this some 20 years ago, I remember walking into the office of one of my dissertation committee members, and I told him that, oh, I'm going to be working on Latin American Protestantism and the political ramifications of that. And he said, well, that'll be really easy. There are no Protestants there. And you multiply each side of the equation by zero, and the problem is essentially solved by going away. But much to his surprise, and I actually had to convince him of this, there's actually a large number of Protestants by the 1990s, so much so that David Stoll and David Martin wrote two separate books on the topic that received a great deal of attention in that year, 1990. So from your vantage point, tell our listeners, what does the contemporary religious landscape in terms of the Catholic-Protestant mix look like in Latin America?
So, as you said, there are some who argue that there are a comparable number of practicing Catholics and Protestants in Latin America, and the number, the figure that's often thrown out is approximately 15% of each. Say approximately 15 to 17% of the population being Protestant, approximately 15% of the population being practicing Catholics. And so, of course, there are some countries where we see a much stronger proportion of Protestants and countries where the numbers are not quite as high.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, two countries that are often that exemplify much of this shift would be Guatemala and Brazil. So, Guatemala, and the proportions range, right? But it appears that perhaps close to a third of the population is Protestant there. Brazil also, some 15 to 17% of the population there is Protestant, and much of it very politically active, so they have quite a visible presence there.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things that you noted when we talked about practicing Catholics and practicing Protestants, you talk about 15% of the population, and that number is a little bit surprising in some regards, because when you think of Latin America, you think of Mexico and the Virgin of Guadalupe and the crucifixes on buildings and the imagery of big cathedrals and central town squares. 15% Catholic participation, at least regular participation, seems pretty low, especially when you compare it to the United States, where you get about 40% of Catholics regularly attending Mass, and not necessarily every week, but a couple times a month. What do you think is going on there?
That's a good question. Well, I mean, I think in your own research, you found some variation there too as well, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in Mexico, perhaps a bit more practice than in other countries. But part of the problem that the Catholic Church faces, of course, in Latin America is that there has been an ongoing shortage of priests, right? And so access to priests, particularly in rural areas, has been minimal in many regions. And another problem, well, perhaps a problem, but there has not been enough of homegrown priests, as it were, right? So a good proportion of priests in some countries, in fact, the majority in some countries are foreign-born. And so some argue that this is a disincentive as well for increased participation by Catholics.
It's just hard when you don't have a priest, and if you have a priest-centric religion, the priest isn't there in the building on Sunday morning.
Precisely.
So what do you do?
Energy and momentum.
Yeah.
When you have, alternatively, perhaps a neighboring Protestant congregation where folks are meeting not just weekly, but perhaps almost daily.
Right. And if you haven't been connected to the Catholic Church, but you still want some religiosity or spirituality, mm-hmm. you look at that and say, hey, that looks pretty good. I'll head on over there.
Precisely. Yeah. And I think an interesting question, I was speaking to a Brazilian student of mine about this very question, and he said, you know what, we're seeing more and more of our, some of our Protestant congregations as well, is that folks that don't necessarily fully leave the Catholic Church in some cases, that may actually attend both in order to meet some of those needs, perhaps, but don't necessarily see that they have to fully reject Catholicism in order to be part of a Pentecostal or neo-Pentecostal congregation.
Yeah, that's become a really interesting problem in measuring who's Protestant and who's Catholic, because you can go down and start interviewing some folks with a survey and say, well, are you Catholic? Are you Protestant? And they might be attending a Pentecostal church all the time, but they say, yeah, I'm Catholic. You know, my parents were Catholic. Exactly. My grandparents were Catholic. So yeah, I'm Catholic. And say, well, where do you go to church? Well, I go to the Church of the Word of God down the road. Well, that's not Catholic. Well, yeah, you know.
It really complicates what we do here.
Yeah, it does. So a lot of the numbers and figures that we talk about tend to be very fuzzy in this regard. But we, you know, as you mentioned, certainly in Brazil and Guatemala and Chile and a few other places, that you've really seen an explosion of Protestantism here.
Yes, in other Central American countries too, El Salvador, Honduras, and others also, very, very high proportion.
It certainly has become more prevalent in the recent decade or so. So while we talk about Brazil and Chile and Guatemala being Protestant early on in the history of Latin America, you now are seeing places like Mexico and even Colombia and Argentina filling up with evangelical Protestants at this point in time. I got a question just in terms of Latin American Protestants. What does the landscape look like? Are there specific denominations that tend to stand out? If you look at here in the United States, you have your Methodist, you have your Baptist, your Presbyterians. What does it look like down in Latin America?
So it's a good question. I mean, there are, of course, mainline denominations that, and many of which have been there for quite some time, Presbyterians, Methodists, Lutherans, Anglicans, even Mennonites, but they do not tend to represent the core of the evangelical or Protestant church in Latin America. Baptists, some fundamentalist churches, are fairly prominent, as are Seventh-day Adventists. And then, of course, Pentecostals are very, very important. And in some countries, some two-thirds of Protestants are, like Brazil, are Pentecostal or neo-Pentecostal, some of the health and wealth congregations that are much more indigenous in orientation.
And what does that mean, neo-Pentecostalism? Because in terms of religious history, Pentecostalism is a relatively new phenomenon, about a century old. And so now all of a sudden they get a term neo-Pentecostalism.
Yeah.
I mean, this is moving fast.
It's true. So Assemblies of God obviously have had a strong mission presence there and have grown fairly well in Latin America, and those are considered, and Foursquare churches, those are considered some of your traditional Pentecostal churches. And then you've had the growth of some churches that are particular to a country, though a number of them have spread as well, that are considered neo-Pentecostal, that are often in urban areas that may be even more decidedly reaching middle and upper classes in urban areas. Because, again, Pentecostalism, if you don't know, often in Latin America has been, and evangelicalism and Protestantism has been very much associated with the lower classes in Latin America altogether. So some of this neo-Pentecostalism then is a bit different in that regard, but it's, of course, not exclusive to those classes. As well, there tends to be a focus here on health and wealth and promises of such associated with participation in those congregations.
So the prosperity gospel type of message that comes out. Do you see any connection between that prosperity gospel message and the fact that these Pentecostal movements have been highly attractive to those in the lowest socioeconomic sectors?
There certainly is great promise associated,
of
course, with participation in those churches. Of course, that can also have a negative effect. I mean, there is attraction. Of course, if some of those attendant changes don't happen rapidly, some folks may chuck the entire faith associated with that. So it can be for good and for bad. But I do think this whole idea of the attraction to evangelicalism, Pentecostalism, in part because of the perhaps improvement in one's standard of living is definitely there. The question is in part how radical those changes might be, right, in one's life. And I think Paul Freston and others who've been doing research on this have kind of summed it up well in the sense that, you know, folks may experience some micro-level changes, but perhaps not macro-level changes in their economic status, not necessarily jumping class, but in part because of the lifestyle changes that tend to go along with this faith, moving away from perhaps drinking and partying and so on, that some of those resources being put back into the family, into the education of one's children, or maybe savings increasing and that being invested in perhaps small business development and so on, that there may be kind of incremental possibilities of change. But the process is probably more gradual than all that. That helps.
Yeah. It takes time to move through that, and again, you can see how quick promises of wealth and health might lead some to become rather disillusioned quickly in terms of this. So we talked a little bit here about the lower socioeconomic groups, but you've done work on women in Latin America, and how do they relate to this Pentecostal or evangelical Protestant movement?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's also years ago, Elizabeth Brusco wrote a piece called A Reformation of Machismo via conversion here to evangelicalism and so on. And so there are some who believe that some women are becoming part of this movement and are becoming evangelical in part for promises of change in terms of a greater a hope, perhaps not for only for their conversion, but that of their spouse and perhaps greater improved family life and improved marriages and so on, and a way of perhaps chipping away at machismo in a way that other efforts have not had success in doing.
Yes, you know, typically we see in the sociological studies of religion that women are the ones who usually convert and then bring their husband along. To use the term of Larry Iannacone, they tend to have greater religious capital, and then the husband, you know, comes along in that regard. And Brusco's work on the Reformation of Machismo I found rather interesting. It does talk quite a bit about how that when a woman converts to Pentecostalism, they can bring the husband in, stop the drinking, stop the philandering, the gambling. Lo and behold, you got a little bit more money in the household. And interestingly, women oftentimes control the household resources in Latin America. And so this provides them some degree of empowerment. What's interesting, though, and Brusco noted this, maybe you can have some comment on this, is that despite the fact that it can be empowering for women at that lower level, the lower micro level, the movement is still predominantly a male-led movement. Is that correct?
Sure. I mean, it may be predominantly male-led in terms of official leadership, though there are, particularly in Pentecostal denominations, there's greater room for women to be preaching and women to be pastors. But what's also different, particularly in Pentecostalism, is that because there's an emphasis on the Holy Spirit and gifts of the Spirit, women, too, can be inspired and speak in tongues and prophesy. And so you have women empowered to speak publicly within congregations. And so even if the theology is fairly traditional in terms of women's official roles within the church or women's roles within the family, some of the actual lived experiences perhaps are more egalitarian than perhaps women's experiences in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, so, being a very democratic or democratizing type of religion in that regard.
It really can be, and I know, and again, this is something that I have a hard time convincing some of my students about because of the nature of the theology that supports much of this, but the reality, and it's very interesting, I think study after study has, many of them have confirmed this, and I should say that many of these studies have focused on evangelical churches or traditional Pentecostal churches. It may be an open question as to how neo-Pentecostal churches will affect women's status, perhaps in the home and within the church. But it does seem like there are changes not only for men but for women. Their exposure to an experience of leadership, even if it's in separate women's organizations within those churches. But the chance to organize, the chance to publicly speak, I mean, the hope, of course, is that there's some spillover effect then within civil society, within the political sphere. Now, there may be some limitations on that, ultimately, but at a minimum, it certainly does seem to be, enabling some change in women's lives that's been unexpected, I think, by many scholars of religion.
That's a really good point that you talk about, the spillover effects in terms of Protestantism is being a much more lay participatory type of religion. It it does provide opportunities to lead Bible study groups or to organize various events and such for the laity. And that does, and I found this in my own research, I know other people have found this as well, it does translate over into civil society. Once you get the confidence that you can organize a Bible study group, bring people together and get them organized, you can do something in your local community and such.
Right. Yeah, that sense of efficacy, that you are capable and perhaps even perhaps more willing, and you can maybe see the power of your own leadership or the power of collective mobilizing to make change. And I do think, yes, I mean, again, maybe this is a gradual process of affecting democracy, but maybe perhaps this is one of the most powerful ways that this religious shift can have implications for democracy in the region.
Yeah,
in terms of the contribution to civil society, right?
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about that later in the podcast, but I think this is a good time to deal with it now, is the issue of the socioeconomic changes that Protestantism might be having on Latin America. There, we tend to think about Protestantism in terms of Weber's Protestant ethic.
Yeah.
That the capitalism, and Max Weber's famous thesis was that Calvinist theology encouraged thriftiness and encouraged a morally virtuous lifestyle that led to capital accumulation, and lo and behold, Europe became economically wealthy and capitalist all at the time here. And many people, including David Martin back in his book Tongues of Fire in 1990, wanted to really test that thesis to see if that is what is going on here. Are we seeing a Protestant ethic in Latin America in the Weberian sense of terms? What's your read on that?
Well, I mean, I certainly think, again, that some of the asceticism associated with the lifestyles of folks who convert in this direction can contribute to that, right? But as I mentioned before, I think there are some limitations in how far that can go in terms of the implications. And your own research has shown that this doesn't necessarily contribute, right, to values that support capitalism any more so than any other person's values, right, in Latin America, or values that are more inclined to be more libertarian than not. So I think it's a curious question, but the linkages are a little more complicated, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. And this is one thing that's difficult for me always to reconcile in my own research, is since I focus on religion and politics, one would always hope that religion is the most important variable so that you can go around trumpeting this to your colleagues and get noticed and published and et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, when it comes to socioeconomic growth and change, major economic changes in Latin America, I think the religious factor is really swamped by a lot of other things that are going on, such as the governmental structure, providing incentives for corruption and thing, the massive inequality in the region and things like that. So it doesn't seem to have that big of impact. I know when Sam Huntington wrote his book, The Third Wave, this was before his more famous Clash of Civilizations book, but he had looked at Latin America saying it was on the one of the first regions of the world to engage in this third wave of democratization in the 1980s, coming out of military regimes. And he made the statement that the reason this is happening is because the Catholic Church has become more Protestant after Vatican Council II. And I just thought it was such a wide sweeping statement that I just couldn't buy that at the time, especially since you had John Paul II, who was in some regards reversing some of the trends of Vatican Council II and making it a much more Catholic type of institution. So in terms of democracy, we talked about economic growth there. What about democracy? Has Protestantism helped to enhance the prospects for stable democracy, more effective democracy? What were your thoughts there?
Well, I think there's some interesting questions there. I mean, partly, one question, that, I mean, a lot of times it's through intermediate means, right? I mean, so of course, one of the arguments about Protestantism's relationship to democracy has to do with, of course, individuals themselves getting scripture in their own hands and being able to read it themselves, and thus the church prioritizing education and literacy as necessary, and not having a priest, of course, to necessarily interpret scripture for us. And so Yes, that, of course, that prioritization is important, but it's also a curious thing these days as more of the evangelical movement in Latin America is decidedly Pentecostal, neo-Pentecostal. I think Woodbury and Shaw point to this question. As there is a greater emphasis, increasingly greater emphasis on the gifts of the Spirit, maybe perhaps even more so than decided biblical literacy, will there be as much emphasis on that particular component in terms of education and literacy? Or, I mean, is the environment already, as you said, the structure such that the state and others are already taking on some of those agendas, so it's not necessarily needed for the church to create that sort of pressure?
Yeah, I think that's the case. That is one of the critiques of some of the neo-Pentecostal movements, is that even though they rely heavily on Scripture, you don't necessarily read it. It's there in very exciting ways in you know, the services and such, but that aspect of literacy. I mean, we did talk earlier about the sense of efficacy that you can gain through organizing parts of your church. I think helps with democracy a little bit and becoming more participatory in the
precisely
community project.
Yeah, and I do think some have worried that this would contribute to political apathy and withdrawal, but I think we've seen way too much evangelical political engagement overall within the region to say that is the norm, right? I mean, we've seen the development of over 20-some evangelical political parties. We've seen many evangelical leaders within a range of parties, non-religious and religious.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are many congregations that see it very appropriate for Protestants to be salt and light in the world and engaged in the public sphere. So I think there's been something of a similar journey that we've seen in the American Protestant evangelical community, as we've seen in Latin America, in terms of a greater trend towards justifying political engagement and participation.
Yeah. I can't remember if I heard this in Paul Frestren's work or if it was somebody else too, that they had made the argument that because Protestants really emphasize, or these Pentecostals really emphasize, morally virtuous living, people in local communities look to them for political leadership because they know those aren't going to be the ones who are corrupt. For a long time, politicians are always ripping us off. And, well, if we elect this Pentecostal leader or somebody associated with this church, you know, chances are that person will manage the budget a little bit better. Now, it doesn't necessarily always turn out that way.
That may be a hope, but as he points, the structure, though, however, is the structure. And so once you enter that, if you're not sophisticated and do not have the capacity to kind of navigate that well, and you haven't thought through how you're going to deal with how things have operated to that point, you're very likely going to be sucked into similar patterns of behavior. And unfortunately, that has been the case, right? I mean, overall, evangelicals engaged politically, unfortunately, have not been markedly different in terms of engagement in corrupt practices thus far. But it reminds me of, I also teach in women in politics, and there are folks who do tend to advocate, add women to the system because they are less corrupt than men, right? Which I always find very troubling as a person of faith and as a Christian who believes in original sin.
Yeah.
As if we add evangelicals, we add women, you add them in stir, and then, of course, everything will be remedied somehow.
Right.
And it's obviously an idealistic vision, and it's not as if evangelicals are not prioritizing morality. One would hope that they would, but again, the process of political engagement, particularly at that level, is just far more complicated than saying, once I enter because God has placed me here, I will be capable of fighting off all corruption. Again, if folks haven't worked through that, it's a fairly dangerous scenario.
Yeah, and it goes to my constant reminding of my students that incentives do matter. That you can hope for the most virtuous of person to enter politics and that all things will be better. But, it's the incentive structure that you face when you're in politics and having to deal with allocating scarce resources that oftentimes gets you in a position where you don't necessarily make the best of choices for society as a whole. I want to go down the path of looking at your article that initially caught my attention and how Protestants in Latin America differ than their brethren in the United States, because we have this idea that, well, you know, we have evangelical Protestants in the United States and evangelical Protestants in Latin America, so they're pretty much the same thing. But I think in order to get to that point first, we have to really understand where these Protestants came from in order to understand the similarity and or differences that we see between them. And so tracking this back over the past half century, century, where has Protestantism in Latin America been a movement that's been imposed by the United States? We're sending down our evangelicals, and here you are, because then you would expect that they're going to be pretty similar. Or what has really been the course?
Same, right?
What's been the historical trajectory here?
Yeah, good question. So in terms of, well, why it's grown, I mean, we started looking at some of those questions as well in terms of the absence of some Catholic leadership, right, creating perhaps a space that Protestants were able to fill and capture some of the religious community in that way. There has certainly been, in the last century, significant investment by North American mission groups in Latin America. So that's been important. However, as scholars of religion in Latin America, most of them would really emphasize these days that most of the growth is not necessarily occurring in those mission churches, but actually in churches based in those countries, and that's where the fastest growth tends to occur, again, not in the mission-based congregation. So while all of that has been important, I'm not sure what you're also saying where within the region growth has been.
Yeah, if you have any thoughts on that. I'm actually interested in that whole issue of the indigenization of the Protestant movement, because it's not as if the Latin American folks created the Protestant Reformation by themselves. They didn't have isolated from the rest of the world, and then they had their own Luther. No, it did come down via missionaries during, the past century. But as you rightly point out, it's an indigenous movement. And I remember in Chile when I was talking to some Methodists to track the history of Pentecostalism in Chile, it really was a breakaway sect from the Methodist missionaries that had come mm-hmm. down there. That basically said, listen, thanks for showing us this new path to the gospel.
Yeah.
It sounds great, but you don't really get us as Chileans, so we're going to strike out on our own. Mm-hmm. And once they started doing that, the movement just really...
It really takes off.
Yeah.
Good point. But I do think some of the mission efforts themselves also tried to facilitate this, also tried to build up local leadership. And of course, then the very nature of Protestantism is such that folks, whenever there's a disagreement, right, not whenever, but very often, it does seem that there's a new denomination or a new church formed, right? So there is already that tendency. And there was a focus, again, on, I think, building local leadership and not necessarily dominating the movement. And I also think what's interesting, of course, and Catholics moved in this direction as well, as you say, and partly due to religious competition, a lot of Protestant missionaries coming in focused on indigenous groups presenting the gospel in their own languages.
Yeah.
Right? And so marginalized groups that perhaps had not been a focus of attention quite to that degree. And so, and that's, again, serious inroads, of course, in Guatemala amongst indigenous groups there, right?
So we just examined here the history of Protestantism in Latin America, and it's important to understand that this is not an imposed or imperialistic tendency of the United States, that Protestantism here in Latin America is really a Latin American phenomena in and of itself.
Right.
And I think that has informed some of the research that you've been doing recently in terms of attitudes that Pentecostals and evangelical Protestants share in relationship to what you might see evangelical Protestants in the United States share. Now, so you went in and did took a look at some survey data here on what Protestants are thinking about in Latin America. So give us a little background on that study.
Yeah, so the reason why, I mean, in part, Dennis and I pursued this question is because I still think even if many scholars of religion in Latin America see growth as far more complicated and not necessarily just financed by not only U.S. missions, but there are some, of course, who see that some that have averred that that growth in Latin America, the Latin American Protestant Church, has been a result of the U.S. government's agenda in Latin America, which they purport then financed some of this shift in the hopes that the rise of Protestantism then would be correlated with greater support for U.S. foreign policy in the region, democracy, capitalism, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And while there are folks who have shown some evidence of governmental support of particular groups and so on, that doesn't explain, obviously, the whole story. And I also think there are those in the U.S., missionaries and televangelists and others who would like to claim a lot more credit than is actually due them for what has happened in
right.
Latin America.
Right.
Right. So so that was one thing we wanted to address. And then what also has been very interesting is Timothy Shaw, Paul Freston, others who have been looking at the nature of evangelicals and their perspectives on various political issues have been finding that, in fact, they do not necessarily look like Protestants or evangelicals in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And so the argument being, and what some of these folks keep saying, is that perhaps on moral issues, on abortion, on marriage, they may look a bit more like American evangelicals, but that on foreign policy, on international issues, they may not look the same, and on economic issues, they may not look the same. They may be much more likely, evangelicals in Latin America, that is, they may be much more likely to support a larger state that invests in social programs and uplift up the poor. So Dennis and I began to look at some of these questions in terms of how do evangelicals in Latin America, as opposed to any other Latin American, how do they perceive U.S. Engagement in Latin America and U.S. foreign policy altogether?
And now you're getting your data from where?
Oh, so we were able to utilize the 2002 Pew Global Attitude Survey.
Okay.
And so the countries that were included in the data set that we were able to utilize because of the questions asked that were appropriate were Bolivia, Brazil, Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, Peru, and Venezuela, and with a sample size of over 5,000.
Yeah. And the year 2002, I think, is important here, too, because this is after the 2001 terrorist attack, the war on terror, U.S. global engagement in Afghanistan, and then Iraq is just on the horizon there, is really starting to heat up. So this is, I think, a really nice test of whether Latin American evangelicals tend to think the way that their U.S. counterparts would think as well.
Right. And so what we find is that altogether, and I mean, I can break this down in a bit, but altogether, there just isn't a remarkable difference between Latin American evangelicals and other Latin Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't necessarily look like American evangelicals in terms of American evangelicals are far more supportive of U.S. international engagement and U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, go ahead and break that down in terms of, let's say, support for war on terror. What were the findings
that
you saw?
And that one's even a little bit complicated because immediately post 9/11, globally, there was some serious empathy, right, with the U.S.
Right.
And some of these efforts, and much of that, of course, that empathy has shifted, or the support for perhaps what we might be venturing to do at that time has waned. But so we looked at basically... What do folks think about the U.S.? What's their opinion of the U.S.? Do they think that the U.S. considers other nations' interests in the policies that it makes? And basically, when it comes down to it, evangelicals and non-evangelicals, there was no difference in how their perspective on the U.S. here in terms of favorability or unfavorability on those questions. Let's see. On other questions here, then we also asked them about perspectives on policy. So, for instance, do they believe that U.S. policies have an effect or no effect on reducing the gap between the rich and the poor? And on that question, for instance, amongst evangelicals, Latin American evangelicals, approximately 41% believe that's the case. Amongst non-evangelicals, approximately 36%.
Yes.
So not a marked difference there.
Right.
Other questions that we looked at, for instance, do folks like the spread of American ideas? Evangelicals at approximately 40% here, non-evangelicals at approximately 34%, We also asked, do they like the American ideas of democracy? Do they like American ways of doing business? And then this final question, as you noted before, do they favor the U.S.-led war on terror? So I should say, I'll start with the last question. Do they favor the U.S.-led war on terror? Again, this is immediately, this is 2002, post-9/11. Evangelicals favored the war on terror. 75% of them did. But of non-evangelicals, 73%. So again, very, very high for both populations. In terms of this question of how Americans do business internationally, basically no difference here. Evangelicals at 56%, non-evangelicals at 55%. Do they like American ideas of democracy? Evangelicals at 50%, non-evangelicals at 53%.
Oh, so yeah. In that regard, the evangelicals are a little bit lower.
Yeah, isn't that?
Yeah. Well, and that's
that
kind
question,
of...
right?
Yeah, that's so interesting.
It's curious. And so when we do multivariate Logan analysis, the only thing where there is still any significant difference between evangelicals and non-evangelicals would be on this question of do they favor or not favor the spread of American ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's slightly greater support for the spread of American ideas amongst evangelicals. So I think altogether, I mean, we don't see a marked difference here. And I should say the non-evangelicals really is just everybody else.
Right. Could be so Catholics, could be just,
mainline.
Yeah.
Mainline Protestants, seculars.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so that is kind of interesting because even though there is, even on the spread of American ideals, you see a little bit of a difference. It's not overwhelmingly great.
It's not overwhelming, and that question is also worded in such an odd way that our kind of post-hoc evaluation of all of this is that, you know, that spread of American ideas could include American ideas of God, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Kind of presumptions of that, which would likely be more positive amongst evangelicals.
Yeah, you would absolutely think that way because you think, well, you know, Latin Americans look to the north and they see Protestantism in the United States. If you had said Latin America is Catholic, United States is Protestant. And so there would be some... You would expect some longing for...
Market difference, right?
Yeah, but there's not. What do you think is going on in terms of this? Why do you not see this big gap between non-evangelicals and evangelicals in terms of their views of the United States and U.S.
Well,
ideas?
Well, this is a big survey, right, in many countries that we pulled all together. So, I mean, I think it shows kind of the breadth of opinion amongst evangelicals altogether in these many nations.
Mm-hmm.
I also just think it shows how independent and how independently minded a number of these evangelicals are. But clearly, they are not following the cues coming from North American evangelicals on how they should think and how they should think about the U.S. and how the U.S. operates in the world.
Yeah, right? Speculate on this a little bit. I mean, they're not following the cues. I'm wondering if they're even getting cues at all. Because in terms of the war on terror, right, you know, the September 11th affected New York, and it was on the television everywhere. But in terms of the war on terror, Latin America is relatively untouched. So if I'm a Latin American Pentecostal going about my day-to-day life, that's not on the top of my mind. And so if Billy Graham or Pat Robertson are saying something in the United States about it, I'm like, you know, that's your thing, right? That's not my thing here. Do you think some of it is just a disconnect that there aren't cues coming between North America and Latin America?
The cues aren't coming necessarily through the church. The ones that they're receiving or they value as important aren't necessarily coming through the transnational ties, right?
Right.
I mean, so I do think those questions are curious on in terms of propensity to support war, period, or support U.S. efforts and military efforts. Evangelicals, again, do not tend to differ in other studies that I've seen as well from non-evangelicals. So I think it's such a complicated history that the U.S. has had in Latin America, and that certainly seems, and the complicated history we've had in terms of support of military regimes in those nations. So I think that certainly may be trumping anything that North American evangelicals may be trying to do in terms of influencing opinion. We've also had, I mean, some of the televangelists, and maybe you may know this better than I do, but some of the televangelists in the U.S. that were most prominent, like Jimmy Swaggart, had such horrific falls, right?
Yeah.
And there are so many televangelists within Latin America. So in terms of who's going to be having the greatest influence, these days you would see greater, it seems to me, disaffection with North America and more of a focus on internal leadership as well.
Yeah, that's true. And it's something I want to bring up here in a few minutes is that North American Protestants really don't have the impact that they may have had many decades ago. In fact, it might be even the reverse, that we're seeing evangelization from the South coming up here to the North in Latin America. I'm thinking of Luis Palau. He has a big, huge ministry out here in Oregon and travels all around the country. And he, I believe, originally got his start in Costa Rica. So you're seeing that effect in that regard. I'm curious, and you might not have an answer to this, but did you break these results down by country? One thing I'm really thinking about here is Venezuela.
And that's a very good suggestion. I wish we had.
Yeah, because I'm wondering to what extent that, you know, certain populist movements. And in 2002, you have Hugo Chavez is still in there, and he's starting to build his support. He's at that time very popular leader.
Popular amongst evangelicals.
Yeah, exactly, and among the lower classes as well. And I'm wondering if that has any impact on it as well. But no, you didn't.
But I do think perhaps there's a slightly less of an animus towards the U.S. than maybe other Latin Americans might have on this question of likes the spread of American ideas, right? But it's not overwhelming.
Yeah.
It's not overwhelming.
Yeah. Let me go ahead and talk about immigration. Now, we just raised that issue here, and you've been studying some immigration recently, and I haven't read your research on this, so my questions might be a little bit off base, and I will give you the latitude to speculate about this. But in terms of Latin American immigration into the United States, which has been a political hot potato over the past few years, if not past several decades, what role does religion play in the immigration equation, if any?
Well, I think that's a good question. Now, I have been focusing in particular on evangelicals in the U.S. and evangelical leadership on this question. And so there is a question of kind of the hospitality being shown towards new immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And they are certainly changing the landscape of our churches here, right? Obviously, both Protestant and Catholic, and there's been in some denominations some serious rejuvenation of those congregations and parishes, right, by very decidedly large Hispanic contingents. So your question was, how has that been shaping?
Yeah, you said you've been looking at evangelicals and the hospitality factor in that regard. What are you finding there?
Well, I mean, that's just a question. What I've been actually trying to understand is how various evangelical organizations in the United States, how they've stood on this issue, and if they've made statements in support of immigration reform, for instance, or not, and why there has been a shift by a number of organizations towards greater support for reform these days. But it's certainly taken some time, right? There was some silence on the issue for a time. And some would say that it is the demographic question that may be driving this issue. But I would say it is far more complicated than that, according to leaders themselves. And I would give them the benefit of the doubt here, that there's more to it, right? I mean, the same accusation has been leveled at Latter-day Saints, right? That some of their support for or the complicated way in which they're looking at immigration is in part driven by their self-interest. But again, I'm not quite sure that that's fair. I think in the case of evangelicals, for instance, what's been happening is there's been a broadening of the issues altogether that they have been prioritizing in terms of wanting to speak out on these various social and political issues and not be known perhaps simply for speaking to issues of abortion and marriage, right? And this seems to be certainly one of them. And the way in which evangelicals are supporting it is very complicated, which seems quite appropriate, right? There seems to be a desire to balance a sense of how can we do this justly and fairly, and how can we be merciful simultaneously. So for many of them, it does mean supporting a process of reform where perhaps there may be some means of redemption for those who are here without documentation, but it doesn't mean that there aren't penalties for not complying with the law, right?
Yeah.
So penalties associated with it, a means of recompense and so on. And as well, there tends to be support for temporary solutions as well, a guest worker program, and all of that in conjunction with increased security so that you don't kind of have the same process occurring in the future, that the process of immigration, perhaps there can be, again, increased channels for legal migration and decreased incentives for illegal immigration.
Yeah, I can see how this becomes an interesting and complex issue for evangelicals, because, again, evangelicals tend to emphasize the redemptive qualities of religion. You're forgiven. You're forgiven for your sins and stuff. But, you know, on the other hand, there are legal prices to pay. It's just you're not just automatically forgiven, but, you know, there's some penance that has to be you know, paid. And if you broke the law and you came across, then we have to deal with that issue.
To deal with that and not just necessarily ignore that for the sake of being merciful or hospitable or welcoming.
Right. So it's not an either-or thing. It's actually a combination of both.
Right.
In that regard. It's what's also, I think, complicates this factor a little bit, too, is the nature of the migration in terms of its religious demographic. Now, normally, and I hear people talk about this all the time, is, oh, we're getting immigration from Mexico, and that's all going to be Catholic. And one would expect that the Catholic Church would be very welcoming of this. And it, indeed, you see that. But what surprised me when I was living in Southern California and talking to some evangelicals down there in Santa Ana, California, they're telling me that, you know, roughly a third of all the immigrants in the Santa Ana area were not Catholic. They were evangelical. So this is, you know, a significant influx, not just of Catholic migrants from Mexico, but evangelicals. They come up here in evangelical
connections and ties. Yeah.
Exactly. And right. Indeed, I know even out here in Washington, when you have migrant workers working in the fields, oftentimes you'll have an evangelical church drive by with a food bus or one of those food carts and, you know, feed the folks during lunchtime and then preach the gospel as a way of really bringing them into their religious fold in that regard. So it's not just simply, you know, a Catholic issue or...
No. And that's the reality. I think a number of congregations say, you know, the mission field has come to us in some ways, right? Or these are also our brothers and sisters, right? So, and I think... certainly some Hispanics who have come here, recent immigrants, are concentrated in you know, the Catholic Church or in Hispanic evangelical congregations, but a number of them are involved in multi-ethnic congregations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so folks being side-by-side, worshiping with them, understanding the dilemma of why folks come here and the nature of our laws, are reconsidering, perhaps, how do we approach this again? Justly and mercifully.
You know, we recently had a podcast with Darren Mather, who was talking about racial attitudes within evangelical churches, and he was specifically talking about racial attitudes toward African Americans. But near the end of the podcast, we had a conversation about how the Global South has been revitalizing, as you mentioned earlier, a number of evangelical churches here in the United States. They come in, they're looking for a place to go on Sunday. They come into these churches, and Darren is in Minnesota, so you can imagine you have the, you know, Norwegian and Swedish, you know, immigrants who came over 100 years ago, that's a very white bread type of denomination. All of a sudden, you know, these very passionate, and that one of the things about evangelical Protestantism in the Global South is very passionate, very animated, and that really tends to have a little bit of clash of cultures within some of these evangelical churches. But as Darren pointed out, it really was for the good. Because folks that have been going to the same church for, you know, decades and generations realize that when these folks come in, they have a passion for Christ. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe it's time to shake up things the way we do things. And so this, what we could call reverse evangelization, is really prompting a lot of new religious activism here in the United States.
Dynamism, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if you've examined that in your research at all or anything.
I have not, but that's really fascinating. I mean, I have looked more at the questions of Where do the laity stand on this? And so looking at some of the Pew data, and it certainly seems, I mean, those who have greater proximity via worship mm-hmm. with immigrants are more likely to be supportive of immigrants. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they will jump to support for legalization of those who are already here in terms of policy, but certainly are more likely to see immigrants as contributing to our society and our economy rather than being a threat to our society and our economy, for instance.
Yeah, that's very much what Darren Mather has found in in his research, that proximity allows us to learn a great deal about one another. And that, and as the world becomes increasingly globalized and transportation becomes easy between Latin America and the United States, as well as parts of Asia and Africa, we're going to see a lot more of this mixing of religious cultures. And it would be fascinating to see how it affects not only the attitudes of Christians in the global South, but how it affects us here in the industrialized North and West. So, well, we're running out of time here. So, Ruth, I want to thank you for being on our show today. You've really brought an interesting perspective in terms of what is going on down there. And we'll be sure to check with your research as it progresses on the immigration issue. It's one that I'm very fascinated with. And very best of wishes on the tenure search.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ruth.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.